this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sun.
Well, I want to play Satchel Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. Ricky on the board. SP Futures down 75. Yeah, 75. Whack, whack, whack here this morning. NASDAQ Futures down 359. Not sure where all this is coming about. Palantir's down 15 bucks. We got a lot of stuff down. We've got NVIDIA down 4, but it was up 4 yesterday. Apple down 220. Microsoft down 4. Amazon down 4, so pretty much a pullback in virtually all of those stocks. We've got Caterpillar down 9. It's been way up, a little bit of a pullback here so far today. Do we have Professor Carl?
Not just yet, Chief.
Well, he'll probably, maybe he'll wake up here at some point. Big news this morning is Dick Cheney, former vice president, dead at 84. I was never really a fan, but I'm sorry the dude's dead. I will say... I seem to recall, and Carl maybe will be able to confirm some of this, that guy had multiple heart procedures when he was in office. He's a triumph of modern medicine. I think he had a bad ticker from old. He was young. I'm glad he made it this far, but he was a big architect of the Iraq War, not a fan. Saying something bad about a poor guy who just died, but he also was a guy who I think kind of started the, I don't know if he started it, but he was involved in Kellogg, Brown, and Root for a while, and he was involved in it when he was in office. And he, I think, was one of the persons that said, by the way, you think you have a convention about not trading when you're in office? Well, guess what? I'm trading. So he was one of the first in a long line of people that evidently showed these, what people thought might have been rules, or nothing more than gentlemen's agreements and not laws, and they could do whatever they damn well pleased. And Carl just emailed me, are we on today? Well, yeah, we're on today. maybe he's caught in the time change. We'll see.
Yeah, I'll try to send him an email or something, with the Zoom invitation.
Yeah, he says he still doesn't see us on Zoom.
All right, I will send it to him.
All right, okay. I think everybody really enjoyed yesterday's show with Diane Kelly, and now everybody, a lot of people are lining up this week. This is going to be like a Veterans Week. We have Carl's comments on that. Tomorrow we're going to have Dr. Johnson, who's done a lot of work in veterans in his area, and with Kevin. And on Friday we're going to have Mike Murphy, who's been on before. He's our soccer expert, and he's our veteran. He's going to be on Friday to tell us about his, what are the veterans' homes and what they do and where he is, and what they did even when over in Europe with the people who were living there. So it should be a very interesting week. And as we might compile all that together and send it off to YouTube or someplace, but I don't know where you send stuff. But I thought Diane was pretty... The amount of hurt... And the amount of people who constantly volunteer for these things. I mean, it's not something you can really pile through your day, but just to be appreciative and at least understand it's, we don't want to, let's put it this way. The people who listen to the show, there's three kinds of people in the world. Some people make things happen, some people watch things happen, and the rest of the people wonder what happened. And we strive on the show to get people out of group number three. So, as best as we can. And I was, very touched by the amount of people that do volunteer work for the Veterans Place. And what Diane does, I don't know if this is for radio, but let's put it this way. Diane is a serious sommelier, and she's had a massive career in wines. And to say that there isn't a wine company in the world that wouldn't pay her any price she wanted is an understatement. And yet she's doing this for Fisher House. She's a pretty spectacular lady, in addition to being very bright and likes to come out and so forth. And how many people in the dark in the morning are going to the veterans' home to serve communion to people in their rooms? It's a very special person, and it's one of those things. Now, is the why the market's gone crazy here this morning? Good question. Maybe it's the government standoff. I don't quite understand what this all is. I mean, I think that the reason why this happens, and I firmly believe this, is in the face of it, if everybody voted for these bills, spending bills, wherever they are, and they knew how much they were going to cost, or allegedly knew how much they were going to cost, every time you raise the debt ceiling, or it comes time to raise it, and everybody bitches one side or the other, you would think, hey guys, all you're trying to do is get a second slice of the apple, you voted for it. I don't think that's the case. I honestly think that whenever these bills are passed, whoever is pushing it, Democrats, Republicans, somehow run all over the Office of Management and Budget, or, as Carl will probably say, there's a way to, because of the rules say that you have to assume that programs that are supposed to stop are going to stop, and then they never do, so turns out you're always spending more than you think you're going to spend. And I think in the last few years, we had, Trump's big, beautiful bill, which is a piece of crap. We had Biden's massive infrastructure bill / giveaway, which was a piece of crap. In Trump's first term, we had the huge tax decrease, allegedly, that that only really made it to a few people. There was some stuff that made it down to the middle class, but not a whole hell of a lot. And all these things have an estimate at the Office of the Management of Budget. And all of them pretty much sucked. So Trump's bill cost a hell of a lot more than people thought, or that he thought, or that those people told us. Biden's bill cost a hell of a lot more than people thought, and now this great, big, beautiful bill is going to... So when it gets to... You sit there and go, okay, if we use these bills and what they're supposed to give us, 2 years from now, we're going to have... our budget deficit is going to not be increasing at the same rate it is now. Not our budget deficit, our total national debt. Well, one leads to the other. And yet when we get there, guess what? We're supposed to be at $32 billion. Zounds, we're at $38 billion. We got to do something. Well, it makes no sense, but it's somewhat of a wake-up call. And it's used as that. It shouldn't be that way, but I sort of can understand. And we're at $38,151 right now. $38,151,000,000. And for some reason, if you add up the monthly treasury statements, it's growing faster than the monthly treasury statements tell you that it is. Now, where all that's coming from, God knows. I mean, Carl may make us... We're having a little problem on our Zoom here this morning, because he's... Carl, you with us?
What went on there? I've had the same Zoom link for a long time. I guess it's changed.
I'm going to bet that you probably have to blame that on Jimmy. He was trying to get Diane on yesterday, and I don't know, maybe he changed it.
Well, I don't know, because I was sitting on the other one, and time came and went, and no chief, and I'm like, well, is something...
Well, does the other one not work, or do we change?
The other one apparently is no longer the correct one, because I was sitting on the other one, and it just sat there and said, waiting for the meeting to start.
Well, without blaming him, am I going to blame Jimmy?
All right, well, hey, here I am, and, everybody is still alive, unlike Dick Cheney, so there you go.
Kevin says, I just logged into the Zoom for the show to make sure it's working. Use the same link you always did. It is fine.
Okay. Well, I used the same link I always did, and it didn't work. So.
Well, whatever. Now, who are my... I can't have a debate between my two high-tech dudes.
Well, you sent me the other... I'll check and see if they're the same link later.
All right. Well, not that I have now. You. What's your feeling on Dick Cheney? I'm mixed on the dude.
Okay. Well, he was a dick.
Isn't he, to a huge extent, a triumph of medical science? Didn't that guy have about 8 heart... No, 8's too many, but a bunch of heart procedures when he was like 40?
Well, he was... Yeah, he's a triumph of, of infinite money over what would otherwise be mortality for basically anyone, right?
Well, what did he have that nobody else could get?
Well, it's just the cash. It's not that nobody else could get it. It's risk reward like everything else. Okay, I mean, it's like this the stuff that's going on with Scott Adams right now. All right, same deal, except that the statistically speaking, this thing that he wants does not work. In fact, it's the same story as Dendrion had, but at 2.5 times the money. Statistically, it does exactly the same thing that Dendrion's Provenge did for metastatic prostate cancer, which is statistically you get 4 months of additional life. The cost for Dendrion's thing was $100,000. They worked on it for years. UCLA was involved in...
Carl, your voice is coming out kind of weird. It's like you're in a reverb unit.
Oh, that's kind of weird. Okay.
No, you're better. We okay.
Provenge was their thing. It just happened. And by the way, it wasn't that I was deliberately looking for them ex post facto. I was during the crazy crash time in 2008. One of the things that I really hated being as a trader was not having anything that I wanted to be long of. Okay, I mean there were a lot of things I wanted to be short of, but that's rather unbalanced, right? So. They were a company that had...
Kevin says Cheney had eight cardiac incidents between 2000 and 2008.
Yeah, I mean, he should have been dead, 8 times, right?
Well...
and it wasn't.
Yeah.
But, you and I and everybody else, this points out, though, that we have a lot of technology that we didn't have, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, right? Some of it applied in sequence in insufficient quantity leads you to being, having 20 more years where, 50 years ago at 60 you'd be dead, okay, as opposed to being dead at 84, right?
Yep.
But then we also have a lot of this medical technology where it's $250,000 in this case, or in the case of Provenge, it's $100,000. The statistics are you get 4 extra months of life and then you die of the same thing anyway. All right. So the question then becomes, and this is where nobody wants to go, but we have to do this. We have to stop this. I don't have any problem with somebody being attached to this mortal coil because, let's face it, we all get up every day and we like it or we wouldn't continue, right?
Well, according to Diane, you say a lot of people don't. A lot of people are blowing themselves away, but that's another story.
Well, people do that, right? But the reality is that this is one of those things that when you're young, you kind of don't think about. But as you get older, you do, especially when you see, like, everybody in your family, take the eternal nap, right?
Well, what's the worst line in all of Irish history? That they're pulling them out of our pen now?
Yeah, I mean, but it's, but that's the thing. So
yeah.
I don't have any problem with that. But what I have a very serious problem with, because it leads to the spiral that we have today, is if I couldn't force someone else to pay for that, or if Adams is a prime example of this, because he's leaning on his health insurance company to cover this $250,000. Now, he's got money.
All right, he's not broke. So he could fork up the cash, but that's not what he's doing. All right, he's got Kaiser's, you know, healthcare, right, out there. And the problem with this is that if there is no pushback on economics, the price becomes whatever you can manage to scam somebody else into covering indirectly. And ultimately what that means is that you and I pay for it.
Without a doubt.
My daughter pays for it, okay? And that spiral does not have the classical supply and demand economic back pressure placed on it, whereas for, say, a Lamborghini, it does, okay? Or for, you know, for a Chevy, well, at least to some extent, right? I mean, you know, until you get people like Elon in there that manage to find a way to scam off $4,000 worth of carbon credits.
Well, somehow this is, and I don't know where, I don't think any of the listeners, and most of the listeners that we have, think things through pretty well. I don't think any person there disagrees with what you're saying. There's no question that a lot of things have come to the, it's almost like the perfect storm, to where the person can demand stuff that they never could really afford on their own, which means, and that's, first of all, that's the basis of insurance, so I'm not criticizing that from the total part there.
Well, no, it's not.
Well, it sort of is, but what I'm saying is, now when you add that to people with new drugs all over the TV saying that they're all going to solve every problem you have, and people going to the doctor and demanding them, and all of a sudden they're, you know, $800 a prescription when they should be $50.
Right.
It starts to become a snowball rolling downhill that becomes an avalanche, which is what we're in.
Right.
I mean, again, the question I always have, when we talk about this, and really when the government does whatever it is the government does, and insurance companies, people have taken advantage of it to an extreme extent. Now the question is, and I always ask, okay, what if? I don't think he would like either one of us. But if Trump would, the both of us, and we'd bring Kevin with, and maybe, you know, could we bring Hal? He'll be talking about some Austrian solution. Anyway, we'd bring Hal. If we all got in a room and we say, okay, how are we going to start this? Like building the side of a railroad car. And there's guys that would say, you take these two pieces and you bolt them together, and you take this one, you bolt them together. There's guys that were called manufacturing engineers that could start this. Now the question is, what would be our five-step plan to fix it?
And I already,
I'm saying it's not going to just be put everybody in jail. I'm talking about literally what would be the first, where would we try and break the chain? Would it be in the advertising? Would it be in the insurance? Where would it be?
No. It's very simple. It's very simple. Everybody has to post a price, and everybody pays the same price.
But I don't. Yeah, that's not. If you don't. I'm not so sure it doesn't start with the patent laws.
No. No, it does not start with the patent laws. Because the thing is this. If everyone has to post a price and everyone has to pay the same price, okay? Just, you know, if you can't extort someone to buy insurance, so-called insurance.
Take my favorite drug, Eliquis, $7,500 a year. Okay, post it. Everybody knows what it is. It's posted.
Okay, wait a minute. Except everyone has to pay the same price, okay?
Which they do.
No, they won't. Not $7,500. And by the way, at the $7,500, which they all have to pay, everyone has to pay it, they won't sell any.
Well, yeah, they do.
No, they don't, because you don't pay it. You make my daughter pay it.
The people that I have talked to about this, I do still help some people out, not with their taxes necessarily, but with their friends of mine. And the people who are on Medicare, they pay half. They're paying $3,500 out of pocket with the Medicare insurance, which is another $600 a year. So really it's $4,100.
Right.
And the Medicare pays, you split it with Medicare. So it's published.
Chief, I understand this. Okay. Now here's the reason that I say no, they don't. All right. If everyone has to pay the same price, it's not just in the United States.
Okay.
Because that's what the law says. Okay. Now, What is the guy in Germany?
See, I think that that's not where we would start. But you and I would have to disagree.
Absolutely.
Honestly, to be honest with you, I don't really care what the guy in Germany plays. I care what people play here. If you cross
you do care what the guy in Germany.
Okay, all right,
Chief.
You're coming at this from the edge. The fact is,
I'm not.
If it costs the manufacturer $500 a year, I want to know why it's costing $7,500.
Because they can sell it. Because the law that says you can't do that isn't enforced.
The issue. I'm going to say they sell 90% of it here.
You're wrong.
Okay, 80%. It's some number, but I want to know how you get from 500 to 7,500. And I'm not telling you I don't care. I do care about whether the fact they sell it for. The reason why they sell it for $1,500 in India is because it only costs them $500.
Well, that's right. So why?
So I'm saying I'm not so worried. I want to know why they're charging $7,500 any place. Let's put it that way. Is it because it's a monopoly?
It's because, well, okay, guess what? The law says monopolies are illegal.
Okay, that's what I'm saying. Where do you start?
You enforce the law.
Okay, but but the monopoly is given to them by the patent law.
No.
Sure it is.
Look, the monopoly on making it is given to them by the patent law.
All right.
However, 15 U.S.C. Chapter 1.
All right. See, you're a brilliant man in your industry. You need to come to the trading floor for a while. If all of a sudden you're right and you have to sell everybody the same price,
yeah.
Guess what happens? The price goes up in India. It doesn't help me here at all.
The price goes up in India and it comes down here because you have to charge the same. Yes, it does.
Just charge everybody $7,500.
No, they won't.
Why?
Because they won't sell any in India. They won't sell any in Germany.
Might.
They won't sell any in Spain. No, they won't. And they know this. And they'd rather sell. Look, if you have no market at a given price because nobody has that kind of money and no one can play the kind of insurance game that they play here in the United States, which you can't anywhere else, and you can't advertise it on television, and you can't do all this other stuff, okay? If you can't do those things, so now, what did you just do? You just destroyed the market for the drug. We're 330 million people in the United States. There's 8 billion souls on this planet.
They make $7,000 on every individual here.
Right.
They make $1,000 on every individual in India. I think they'll be happy to sacrifice those guys to keep the deal going here.
They'll have to sacrifice all of them everywhere else, and they won't.
And you know what they'll do? They'll drop back to some thing where if you, I don't know who makes the damn stuff, if you wrote them a letter and say you can't afford it, then they have all the stuff, well, if you can't afford it, talk to America.
Can't do that either. That's illegal, too.
Okay, well, but people, then it becomes a charity thing. We'll give it away to the poor people. We'll do something.
Chief, it's against the law.
I think it needs. We need to go to. Let's change this. We're not going to agree on this, but that's not where I would start. Let's put it that. That's why the three of us would be in a room and we'd be arguing, because somehow or another, it's not a 17-year patent, and there needs to be some sort of governor on a patent, right? There was a governor on. I go back to my railroad roots. You give somebody a railroad line, he puts the line up, and Carl comes up and says, I need to get my corn to market. Okay. How much is it? How much you got? Okay. When you give somebody a monopoly, there has to be a governor on it of some kind.
Well, what you had in it, and boy, I know a little bit about this because guess who had to deal with monopoly providers when I was running my internet company? That'd be me.
Oh, you? Because everybody had to deal with it. Cable companies, everybody else.
Well, because we had this situation come up with circuits. Okay. And oh, by the way, the paths on which those run happen to be rights of way, which are a monopoly, right? I mean, there aren't four cables for cable companies running outside your house.
Right.
All right. Same thing with the water and the sewer lines. All right. So same deal within large parts of the infrastructure, but not everywhere. All right. I mean, in long haul circuits, there actually was competition at the time, but there wasn't on the local end. All right, so the ICC had published tariffs just like they do for bills of lading and you know, carriage on railroads and things like this. All right? Everyone pays the same price.
Right. I get
well, all right, so everyone pays. Guess what? The solution to the fact that you had a natural monopoly, in this case, because you have one railroad line, all right, or in the case of a water and a sewer line, or in the case of whatever have you, the answer to this is everyone pays the same price.
That could be the solution.
It is the solution.
Okay, but now, but then you have... It isn't so much the solution, Carl, because... And you get politics involved. I mean, everything has a
all
problem.
So basically,
there.
What you're saying is you're making an excuse for people breaking the law, and then you're saying
I'm not. I didn't once say that I like that people did that. What I said was that somehow or another, that's the idea that we're not going to let them sell it in India is not a solution for the person.
They are going to sell it in India, but they're going to have to sell it at the same price they sold in the United States.
I'm not saying this isn't a problem. It's just not where I would start.
You know what? If you did this, then every single procedure in a medical center would be the same situation. This thing that just
all right,
came
so then
up,
they're going to license the Eliquis to somebody who makes it in China, and he's going to sell it in India for the right price. I mean, I'm pretty good at get arounds. I don't.
Well, you
sell
know what?
It.
And you know what? And then what's going to happen is the people in the company that hold the patent are going to get frog marked out of their office and go to prison.
We have people here. You know who was the first at this? Was, what's the name of the company? The first drug company to move. They're long gone. I can't remember. U.S. something something? They moved to Bermuda.
Okay.
They moved to Bermuda.
Right.
They took the patents to Bermuda, and then they took their taxes overseas because they then paid the new company for use of the U.S. patents.
Right. And you know what? And the answer to people who commit tax evasion... Gee.
That's not tax evasion. It was fine.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well,
you know. I agree with you on this, but I'm saying it was perfectly legal.
Chief, I am. Look,
you're looking for the same thing I'm looking for. You're looking for the smell test. I'm saying, where's the smell test?
Well, yeah, I'm looking for the smell test.
Yeah.
And the thing is this: we have a system. Every hospital in this country. I just got done driving across it again.
I'm not sure. Hey, Ricky, I'm not so sure if we have Joel today. If he pops on, let him in. Otherwise, we'll just keep going with Carl.
Yeah, I'll let you know.
Yeah. So I haven't seen him pop up yet. If he does, I'll ball.
He told me he was out 2 weeks. I think this might have been one of the weeks he was out. So
well, there you go. So here's the thing. All right, we have examples of this all day long. All right, we just had one that was written up and was this it's a sob story. A physician in Colorado, all right, an actual doctor, all right, gets into a relatively minor car wreck, all right? Not totally minor.
Hey, if you got a new car, there's no such thing as a minor car wreck.
Well, it broke her ankle.
Okay.
All right, so
talk about the judge that put the little scratch in the lady's car when he pulled in. He said, you could barely see, it was $1,500. Had to replace.
No. This is, for real, like I can't walk because my ankle's busted.
All right, yeah, that's
all
real.
Right, so, yeah, so she gets, she gets taken to the hospital because, you can't walk away from it, right?
No.
Your ankle's in three pieces. Okay, fine. So they fix it. Now, then... She, of course, being a professional and in the medical field, whatever, has supposedly pretty decent insurance. Well, guess what? The hospital codes this thing in a way that the insurance company tells her to pound sand and sends her a bill for $70,000.
They weren't in the network or something?
Yeah. Now, by the way, that's illegal now under the things that have been done over the years, in that in network or not, in a true emergency, you can't get gouged like this. Okay, well, she goes around with these people for and they're trying to play these loophole games and everything else. It gets resolved, but here's where the problem is.
Well, did she have to pay in the meantime, or the bill just stayed out there?
No, well, they were threatening to send it to collections and screw
her credit
up. Okay.
Yeah.
So basically, this ultimately does get resolved. But here's where, in the process of resolving it, they managed to disclose the felony, the extortion and racketeering felony. And how do they disclose
it? They're not ashamed of it. They're proud of it.
Now, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. At the end of the day, The way this gets resolved is, yeah, the insurance company does pay because the law says they have to, right? However, they pay $20,000 and the bill is clean.
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt.
Now, wait a minute. 70 versus 20. All right. Well, excuse me. That's racketeering.
It's now. It's every bill.
Chief, you want to solve this, you start frog marching people and it goes away today.
We have Joel is up. We have a debate on where we're going to start. We know where we want to go, and it would be a lively session.
I'm just telling you, I fix it in a day.
I fix it one day. Before Joel, let me give you a real quick thing. When I had the heart rhythm issue like 25 years ago or 20 years ago, I was at Northwestern, right? And back in those days, they weren't tied in with the insurance companies as much as they are now, so the bills would go back and forth as they were fighting over the amount, right?
Right.
So the trick was to not pay any of the bills until you finally got two in a row.
Until you got the last
one. Well, you got two that were the same number. So now they finally agreed on a number. So all of a sudden I get a call from this guy who's a collection agent. And he goes, I think I owed, my share ended up being like $3,000 or something, which was okay.
Which was both.
And so the guy calls me and he goes, you know, you owe us $3,000 and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, you know, I don't owe you anything. I owe like the hospital. Well, you owe us. We're the collection agent. I said,
We bought it.
I said, I'm going to call the hospital. He goes, you're forbidden to call the hospital. And I go, you're forbidding me to call the hospital? Well, now my Irish is up, right? Who the bleep are you and where can I meet you? type of thing. Which, you know, I was younger then. And so I call the hospital. Guess what they tell me? Well, are you going to pay it in full? And I go, well, yeah. Oh, we got a 50% discount. Give me your credit card number.
Yeah, exactly.
And the guy's forbidding me to call. Meanwhile, the hospital's making me a deal. You could write fiction like this, Carl.
This kind of crap is stopped instantly with one pair of handcuffs.
Oh, probably. All right, we'll talk to you on Friday because we'll have the end of the veterans thing, so you can comment on that on Friday. It'd be cool.
Oh, we're also going to have the jobs. Well, maybe the jobs report.
Got it.
All right,
Joel, how are you, buddy?
Good morning, Chief. How you doing on this Tuesday?
I'm doing
morning?
Good. I'm actually all fired up this week because of all the veteran stuff we're doing.
Okay.
We had Diane yesterday, and we're having a psychologist tomorrow, and we're having a veteran on Friday, so we're trying to compile it all together. And
that's nice.
Yeah,
that's nice.
It's cool.
Hopefully the veterans are getting out of this market.
What do you make it today? There's got to be – I've been searching all morning here for the reason. What is it?
Crowded market.
Was crowded yesterday.
Yeah, and it was crowded the day before, and the day before, and the day before, and the debate the day before. This market shouldn't be at the levels that it's at, and it's going to correct, and people need to prepare themselves for that. We should not be at these levels.
I'm sure you have a screen in front of you. I've seen you guys in the show. By the way, I need to come back on. I love coming on.
Get you on, Chief. Get you on real soon. We'll get you on. We're booking in. We're getting so popular, we're booking into January now. But
you
Chief,
ought to be, you ought to be
top
popular.
Priority.
You ought to be popular. It's a hell of a good show.
No, Chief, you know, you have your Palantir earnings today that, you know, were pretty darn good, right? And raised guidance. It's just the market's gotten way ahead of itself. Some of these stocks are trading on expectations that are probably not going to happen for 3, 4, or 5 years.
Palantir's revenue per share is $1.50.
Okay, you had a Fed come out and tell you that December is not a slam dunk, right?
Yep.
Right, just the rate cut. Okay, so that there's a rug pull there. If you could give me an update on where we actually are at with these trade negotiations, the floor is yours. I'll give it to Carl or Hal or anybody. You guys tell me where we're at with these trade negotiations.
What does it tell you? Looking at your screen, and you're more of a screen guy than me, when you see the VIX, after rallies day after day, still in the 17 number, and yesterday I marveled at my screen. NVIDIA was up $4 or $5. A couple other things were up. The rest of the screen was red. On an up day. I mean, the narrowness is bizarre, but it's been narrow for a while. You can't say, well, yesterday was narrow. I'm going to sell this morning. I mean, God, if you did that every day, you'd be carried out with your feet first. Oracle's down. I mean, is there going to be a come to Jesus day, or what is it? I don't.
You know what? There has been. I mean, if you look at your RSP, if you're exactly right. What's been going on over the last couple days? You know, rotation. Everything has saved us. But there's a point, and if you want to look at excess in this market, okay, and you can look at your tech stocks, and you can look at your AI stocks, you look at everything, but have you noticed the price action in Bitcoin?
It's been going down heavy.
Couple weeks.
Yeah.
Which is the king of excess in this market, right?
It's a fake stock.
What
has this
been doing? What has the market been doing? What has that been doing as the market's inched up to all-time highs?
It's been going straight down.
Exactly. And if that's not a symbol of excess in the market, then I don't know what it is. And I think it's tipping you off of, because you talk about something that has perceived value, but who knows really know what the intrinsic value is?
Zero.
Can you go down to the Starbucks around the corner from you and buy a $5.85 latte with Bitcoin?
Somebody tried to do that way back in the day, but no, you can't.
Okay, so I mean, I know sometimes I get overdone on the bullish side and sometimes overdone on the bearish side, but I think people have to look at what the market has done this year and temper their expectations for the end of the year and also for 2026. And I'm not saying, all these Wall Street guys that are, 7,000 is just around the corner. Maybe, but they need to tell me what the catalyst is.
Another $1 trillion in Bitcoin or in NVIDIA.
Okay. All right. Well,
I mean, but that's what's been happening. I mean, there's no ceiling for any of these things. There's no, you and I have noticed, and Carl has helped out with this. We've noticed, they seem to be buying into companies and they're using the money to turn around and buy stuff from them, which is a little. I mean, it's not. And you've known, last week we talked about, what do they have, 4 or 5 customers is 80% of their stuff, right?
Yep. You can hate on Warren Buffett all you want, and the king of cash and everything that he's had, but okay, maybe he sold out of some stocks, Delta, at the low during COVID, and he didn't hold on to his TSM and stuff. But overall, slow and steady wins the race, and you see what he's investing in right now.
Yeah,
so,
well, isn't he like with the single biggest private owner of T-bills or something?
Yep. So I don't know if I want those either. But anyways, you could be bullish and you could be bearish, but you should always be cautious.
Well,
and that is my theme for today. For the rest of the week, for the rest of the month, and in 2026.
What do you think? There's a segment here. I mean, obviously the seven or eight or nine. It's more like 10 now when you talk about Palantir and stuff in there. Have led the market. Are they? We have, and I'm not going to name the stocks. We have a lot of concentration issues here at PTI, where people trust me to, if they have a big holding in one stock, maybe they inherited it or they work there or something. We protect it. I'll tell you what, Joel, a few of those stocks, they're going straight down. Boy, if we didn't have puts.
I have a few of those. And, I would love to do it. But I got to hop it out.
All right, buddy.
Just before I go, you've heard about different orders, right, in the market. GTC.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Good till canceled. FOK, you remember what that was?
Yeah.
Okay, MOC.
Market on close. We don't know those anymore.
Okay. MIT.
That one was what? Market have touched.
Okay.
It's a long time ago. I used to give lectures on this.
Okay. Did you ever give? And I'm not going to give what it actually stands for. But in some of these stocks, GTFO.
Good till fall apart or something.
I'm not going
to. Good till. I get it. Good till bleep
get
off.
The blank out.
Yep.
Okay. All right, folks. Everyone have a good day.
By the way, you'd have been a good friend of my grandfather's. Never be afraid to leave a little something for the next guy.
All right, go blue.
Take care. Do we have Kenny?
We do.
Kenny, You realize what you started last week, or maybe not started. We now have a whole week of veteran stuff, and Diane is dying to come on with you. Talk about
who
you.
Is?
Diane Kelly was on yesterday. She is a, well, she's been a volunteer at the veterans team here for a while, but now she's the head of Fisher House, Illinois. She retired from her Saint Monnier job where she was making a real lot. Now she doesn't make a whole lot for being the head of Fisher House, but she has supervised the new Fisher House opening up by Great Lakes. And she was the one who first turned us on to the psychological problems that a lot of people are having, and there's not as much money for that as there is for the other stuff. And yesterday she was giving us some of the statistics on suicide, and I said, well, you know, funny you should mention it. Kenny just kind of offhanded comment that he did a big fundraiser for people out in New York, and she's dying to be on with you to talk about what you're doing and what exactly the money's going for and how many doctors they're hiring. And then tomorrow, I have a psychologist, my roommate in college, Dr. Mark Johnson, who's done a lot of work with veterans up in New Hampshire. And yep. We're having a veteran coming on Friday. So see what you started?
How great is that?
It's a, you know, that's great. I'm more psyched about this week than I have been doing a show in 5 years. I mean, it's...
Yeah. No, I hear you. It's an exciting thing to talk about, really. You know, we raised, like I said, $4.3 million, maybe a little bit more. We're still, you know, kind of count those, even the small donations that came in, but $4.3 million on behalf of mental health for veterans, right? Because that's what we do. And we've got an 84% administration funding rate, which means 84% of every one of those dollars goes directly
That's terrific.
To the veteran, right? Which is a great number. That's a great number, the AFR rate. And I'm happy to talk to her. If you want to connect us, send me an email and connect us. I'd be happy to talk to her and connect her to, you know, to the group at Headstrong.
Well, that I will do for sure, but we're trying to get you guys on together someday when you can be on maybe a little longer.
Oh, great. That's perfect. I'm happy to do that, too.
Because, boy, she was whipping out some suicide rates that are awful.
They are awful. Actually, next Tuesday is Veterans Day, right?
Yep.
So, Tuesday morning, if it works.
Is it on a Monday, or is it the...
No, it's Tuesday the 11th is Veterans Day.
Right, okay.
So that if you're up, you know, if it works, I'll be happy.
Actually,
that's
a date she gave me.
So maybe that's Veterans Day.
Yeah, that will work. That'll work maybe pretty darn good. I'll get back to you on that. Tomorrow? What I'd like to do with Dr. Johnson is first of all, I want to ask him: is the mental stuff PTSD is it the same every war, or are they sort of unique every war?
I'd have to say they're probably unique to every war, but I'm not the expert. But my gut would say it's probably unique because every war is different,
yeah.
Right? In terms of the weapons they use and the, every experience, right, is different. So I would imagine it's going to be different.
I would think you're probably right. I also wanted to, as you know, I'm never going to lose my cost accounting background. When you say you've got $4.3 million. Which is fantastic, yeah. By the way. I like to look at it the other end. Okay, if I'm going to help these 30 guys,
yeah,
is it a visit a week, a visit a month? Can they do it from home? What is the cost per person to do it right? And how many people do we have? And how much do we need? I mean, I like to work from the bottom up instead of the top down.
Yeah. So again, depending on who you are, the type of where you are in your journey with PTSD, we see clients twice a week if we have to, twice a week if we have to. That's far, far better than what the VA. You know, you're lucky if you see the VA once every 45 days. But one way or the other, we can see them twice a week, and it costs about $9,000 to treat a veteran for about 8 or 9 months. Right, completely cost free, completely bureaucracy free for that veteran.
Now, do you go there?
They scale down to once a month, maybe, but and you can stretch out a bit longer. But we'll see them twice a week if we have to.
Okay, now when you say see, you go there, they go to you. It's a by phone, combination,
so,
all the
so
above.
So it depends because we've got clinicians in place in parts of the country, and we have telehealth in other parts of the country. But we cover the whole country, right? Everyone should know we cover the whole country. And right now we're serving, 18 plus 100 veterans you know, maybe even closer to 2,000 veterans across the country, both in telehealth as well as in person. So it depends on kind of where they're located. That would depend on you know, whether the service is telehealth or in person.
What's the name of the outfit again, in case anybody missed it?
Yeah, because we're in 19 states physically where we can see people. In the other states, we're telehealth, right? And like I said, it costs about $9,000 to serve a veteran for about 8 or 9 months. And once they scale back and they can do once a month, you can stretch that out closer to a year. But some veterans, you know, they come in and they need to be seen twice a week, which is what we'll do. Other veterans, you know, less so, but we'll cover them for, you know, up to about a year, completely cost free to the veteran.
What's the name of the
called the Headstrong Project, and you can go to the headstrongproject.org, O-R-G online. You can just see you'll see pictures and story of our latest gala, which was, you know, October 22nd. We had, you know, President Clinton was there, and he presented the Moral Courage Award to a family, a former Navy SEAL, whose son, also a Navy SEAL, lost his life. Frank Larkin was the Navy SEAL, the mother and father, Mr. and Mrs. Frank Larkin. And their son took his life to suicide, also a Navy SEAL, but just couldn't deal with it. And so President Clinton was there and gave that family the Moral Courage Award, because they have then, after their son's death, the husband and wife jumped into, you know, serving veterans that suffer from mental health to try to make a difference. So it was really an amazing. We had 900 people at the Chelsea Piers in Manhattan, and we raised, like I said, we raised just over maybe little over $4.3 million.
That's spectacular.
Which is great. Yeah, it's spectacular.
Diane was said it's, the gamut is, it's so multi. Some people killed people and are all upset about that. Some people are wounded. Some people saw their buddies get killed and they didn't get killed. Some people came home and the family's long gone. They don't have anybody here. There's no extended group to talk about it. There's no VFW hall. There's no anything like that.
Yeah,
It's a huge, you know, a la carte of what every person is affected differently by different stuff. If somebody has a huge support thing here, it's probably better, but even then, if they saw 15 of their buddies get killed, that's a problem. If they lost limbs, that's a problem. I mean, everybody's so different, it's kind of scary.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's completely scary. You know, and even the guys that suffer from mental health and lose their limbs, you know, they are certainly right at the front. But then there are plenty of guys that, you know, don't lose their limbs, but they just can't process, right?
Right.
And they struggle, and this is what we do, and we serve these guys.
Is there any
men and women?
Do you go through the local veterans' home or no? It's totally separate.
No, we don't. We're connected, and we have relationships like with the VA and that kind of stuff, and different veterans organizations around the country. But we're separate. We're a separate, you know, organization. We got started in 2012. This is now entering our 14th year of serving veterans, and we grow every year. And now that we've had government cutbacks and all that, we've seen a surge in veterans coming to the Headstrong Project looking for help, right? We've seen probably a 20% surge in cases, veterans that now come to that have been coming to us for help. And so it becomes even more of a necessity to raise money and so that we can continue to serve these guys, you know, completely cost free and anonymous and bureaucracy free.
So you don't, obviously, you're saying, I'll just summarize, you don't have a couple of guys that like work the Maywood Veterans Home or something like that?
No, we don't.
You know what?
We're connected to a bunch of different, you know, veterans organizations all around the country.
Okay,
But no, not at all.
Well, you know what Diane brought up, and I don't know if you've heard this through your group, is that the latest Fisher House is up at, there's a name for it, but it's up at Great Lakes, where I guess most of all the Navy people get trained, right?
Uh-huh.
And it's the only veterans home, evidently, that's designed for not only veterans, but for people who are active duty.
Right.
And she says the amount of mental problems in the people in active duty is something they never expected. She says it's huge.
Yep. 100, yeah. We see that, you know, we treat some of them, right, in active duty.
How do you do that? How do you find them?
Right. Right. That's the ones that are in active duty is a fee for service program if you're in active duty, but if you're out, if you're out, then you know, then you can we cover you, bureaucracy free and cost free.
Well, because the guy who comes on after you on Tuesday, Professor Hal Snar, he was a nuclear, he worked on nuclear ships in the Navy for a while. And he didn't want to be on a submarine, so he was on a cruiser. Remember, they had a couple old atomic cruisers or nuclear cruisers.
Uh-huh.
He was on one of those. He goes, I think he said 6-7 weeks in the Persian Gulf. Water's 93 degrees. One of the water scrubbers didn't work. He was down in the engine room, was 120 the whole way, and he goes, it was incredible. I mean, I can imagine guys like in the South Pacific in World War II and ships that weren't even air conditioned and stuff. I mean, there had to be problems in the Navy, not just when you got out.
Yeah.
And how many people could handle that? I mean,
right, exactly. And you don't know, like you said, it's everyone's own experience, right, that defines how they react or how much service they need or how they, you know, how they struggle, really, right?
Okay,
listen,
this would
be a great conversation. If you can do that for next Tuesday, I can get my wife, you know, is director of development at the organization. She's been there since day one. And so I would get her on the phone to have the conversation because she's got much more of the facts and the data and kind of where they're going in her head because she does it every day. I should be happy to jump on and have that conversation.
Well, that's true. We'll figure it out. We'll maybe move some people around a little bit if we have to. Your shorts, booze. When did you get the call that we should sell this morning?
I didn't get the call, but last night after Palantir completely crushed it, right? They crushed it on every metric, every single metric. They crushed it. They doubled this. They doubled their revenues. They doubled everything like else. And then suddenly, you know, all the analysts are saying, well, you know, its valuations are really stretched and we're not sure that this can go on. And so now, you know, you're getting this market pullback. But look, I'm not surprised. How long have you and I been talking about the valuations being stretched, yet they got stretched and stretched and stretched some more? All you need is one. And listen, I wouldn't mind if Palantir missed it, then, you know, it would be even worse than what it is. But Palantir crushed it, and they're still selling the market off, you know, 1.5% by the time the day's over. Europe is all down between 1.25%, 1.5%. I suspect that's what we're going to see here today. But I'm not surprised either because the market has been stretched for a while. So it just needed something to kind of kick it off. I don't think this is going to be the beginning of the end at all. But I do think there'll be kind of this come to reality moment where they realize they've been a little bit too anxious, maybe. And so we'll see a little bit of a pullback and some consolidation, which I think is actually very good and very healthy.
Okay, tell me I'm wrong here, but when people come out and people that follow it like you and you say they crushed it, they're doubling their revenue, right?
Yeah.
I've always thought in my bazillion years in the business that sometimes the earnings, whether they're good or whether they're bad, for one time a quarter, it causes people maybe to actually look at the numbers.
Yeah.
And when you look at a Palantir and you go, I mean, I've been squawking about this thing for weeks now that their stock's trading 200 and something, and it's their revenue is $1.50 a share.
Right.
But nobody looks at that, and nobody wants to hear me, to be honest with you.
They don't want to hear it when it's going up, and they own it. All they want to know is that, look, this, how great is this? I'm a brain surgeon.
So
you know. And so they don't want to hear it until it starts to get negative, and then everyone gets nervous.
But I mean,
which is exactly what happens. Which is, you know, I mean, you and I both know it. How many times have we seen it? Today is no reason for me, you know, to all of a sudden open up my account and hit the sell button on everything. Absolutely not. If anything, you know, I'm going to look at the names that over the next couple of days maybe get arbitrarily dislocated in terms of price, and then look at that as an opportunity. Because unless the fundamental story has changed, then I think it's okay.
Well, I think it causes might cause somebody to, who just, let's face it, there's a lot of momentum trading in the market. It has been for quite a while. And people are buying Palantir because it goes up. I mean, I know that. I have clients, for God's sake. So, if somebody looks at it and goes, hey, great, their revenue's doubling. What's their revenue? Well, now it's $3 a share. How much is this? What's this pig trading? 200? That's doubling, or $3. That's kind of a lot. Maybe just the fact that you looked at it for the first time in your life caused you to sell.
You're right. Yeah, no. You can't argue the AI trade. It is amazing what's happening. You know, yesterday's, there were four AI, there were $53 billion worth of deals announced yesterday morning before the bell between NVIDIA and OpenAI and Microsoft and Cypher and Iron, right? All these new names are coming onto the scene, and they're making these massive deals. And so it is exciting. We are entering kind of a new era in my mind, and we're still very much at the beginning of it. So while I think there's plenty of room to run, again, you have to be realistic. And, you know, when you get ahead of yourself, you have to realize you're a little bit ahead of yourself.
What do you say to somebody like Carl, who's been on he's been on the show forever, and he's been in this. He says the estimates that people are making in AI in terms of how long the machines are going to be worth something, how long this thing is going to stay on the cutting edge, are like, most of them are like 10 years. And he's been in the business for 40 years. He goes, nothing is ever cutting edge for more than 2 or 3 years. These guys are way over the top in all these estimates and stuff. He goes, there isn't a person yet who's made a dime from AI. There are people selling the stuff, buying the stuff. And Russell last week was talking about NVIDIA. He likes them on the rest because they're selling the stuff to all these guys with the pie in the sky estimates. Because they're almost a shovel company in the gold rush.
Correct. But I will say there are people like you and me, just joke you public people, that are making money using AI. But to your point, you're talking about the big companies. And you're right. But I still think we're very much in the infant stages. I do think it's coming. I don't think it's going away by any stretch. And I don't think it's going to get, I think it's going to get more and more sophisticated almost by the day. You can watch it.
But
it's
changed
so much between one day to the next.
Well, for a total Luddite like me, which I admit to being, by the way, I mean, when I used to do my revenue per share stuff, I used to have to go to Yahoo or someplace, and I get the revenue and I get the amount of shares, and I actually have to do a 30-second calculation, which I'm perfectly capable of doing. Well, now, all I have to do is say, Palantir revenue per share, and at the top of the Google thing, there's AI
and
telling
it tells
me.
You.
But,
right.
But I'm not paying for it.
I mean, correct. That's right. You're not paying for that. You're not paying for that. For that information. I'm talking about people that are now running businesses using AI. You see it every day on whether it's on Twitter or on Instagram. Do this, use AI, do this, make money using AI, blah, blah, blah. There is a part of the market that is absolutely making money using AI. But for you and me, when we go to our Google search and it's using, Google's AI chatbot to find information and to give you information, you're right. We're not paying for that.
And Carl's point is at the end of the day, where, the extent that it helps Amazon run their business more efficiently, if it does, that's one thing. But when you get to the part where they charge us for it, right now it seems like it's not. I don't know where the gain is. I mean, clearly, I don't know what advances in accounting and manufacturing and things like that it does for Ford. It probably helps a little bit, but I don't know that it probably helps on the supply chain a little bit. I mean, I don't know. I guess the question is, these guys are spending an awful lot of dough. Where's the quantifiable piece of this?
Look at the way it's changing banking, or look at the way it's even changing research, right? The ability to use AI to help analysts in research. They can become much more productive using AI as an assistant, right, to their research,
I'm
whether
sure.
you're a law firm or whether you're a research firm. I mean, it's crazy. And yes, I agree with you. I don't know where does it end, or how do you quantify it? I think it's still too early to quantify it. Do I think we're ahead of ourselves? Yes. But do I think it's going away? No.
Well, I also think they're going to run into some clear issues about copyright. Of course, we don't care about copyrights and stuff anymore. But it might come a time when we do.
Yeah.
I mean, I know the internet for me. And again, I'm nothing like Carl and Kevin when it comes to using the internet, but every time I go somewhere now, I get blocked. I can't get into the Tribune. I can't get into the Washington Post. You know, what happens if
you
everybody
get blocked because they want you to you to subscribe and sign up? You mean?
Yeah, or pay.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how AI gets into the DePaul Law Library and starts grabbing people's papers. I mean, I can't do that.
I don't think they can do that.
I think they are. I think a lot of it, they have some kind of license, or maybe they do. When we start talking about, researching all this law stuff, I mean, you can go to the I guess, the government site and yeah. find out. But I don't know that you can go read all the stuff done by law professors for free, and yet somehow, I mean, I guess there's a million questions here that are
still unanswerable.
Yeah,
because right? to your point, I don't know the answer to that either. But we can see how every day it's changing our life. Look, this deal yesterday that OpenAI made with Amazon, it's going to give OpenAI access to the whole Amazon web services that's going to help train it, right? All yeah. the data that Amazon web services have, OpenAI now is going to have access to.
Well, you know, right?
Train those models. So whatever information that is.
The thing that is barking me the wrong way here. And I, you know what? Kenny, you're on a trading floor as long as I have. You're wrong a lot. If you make 30 trades a day, you're wrong every day on
right,
10 of them,
only
right?
as good as your last yeah. trade. 100%.
But when the cloud started, and Kevin, yeah. when Kevin was on the show, and Kevin was he was at Better World Books in those days, and he said, well, the cloud is nothing more than in buying access to computers for your busy times from other people.
Right.
And he said, you know, Better World Books sold a lot of textbooks. If you go to Amazon and you buy a textbook, you're probably buying it from Better World Books. And he goes, in September and in January, we need a lot more computer capacity than we have. He goes, right. this is 10 years ago. Kevin goes,
yeah.
It's already becoming a commodity. I can buy it from Amazon. I might buy it from Amazon because we're hooked up to them. They get an advantage. But I also got a guy right in the area here. There's a bunch of servers. I can buy them for him. It's already becoming very competitive. And I remember Microsoft, and you'll remember this if you dig back of the cluttered brain we both have. Microsoft was going to put up those cloud places all over the country that we're going to take. The first one they were building was here, I believe, in Schaumburg or Mount Prospect. And they were going to use like 40% of all the electricity in Mount Prospect. And they were looking at Commonwealth Edison to make sure they had enough. And they were going to build, I don't know how many places around the country. Well, this one here took a little longer than they thought. I don't know if they ever finished it, Kenny, but they canceled all the rest of them.
Yeah.
So when I see these guys for AI buying their own, like, nuclear facilities for all the power and stuff, I get this feeling, this sounds like a lot like the cloud thing. And you wonder 5 years from now if all of a sudden the machines and the servers and they use, they're not going to need any of that stuff. You just wonder. I mean, because we progress
right,
so fast.
But we'll need something else, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, all of a sudden we're... I mean, what did Bill Moriarty was on last week? And are we listening? He was talking about in Corpus Christi, some massive firm wanted to put some AI or God knows what, a data center down there. And they needed all this water. And Corpus Christi is short on water anyway. So they have this big desalination plant going. It gets higher and higher and higher in cost. And finally, the city said, screw the desalination plant, and you guys don't come here. Because you know it's because they push back that there isn't enough water for you guys, but I have a feeling that 5 years from now, those centers aren't going to need that much water, that much power.
I mean, yeah. Well, I guess we're going to find out as we move through it.
Well, yeah.
All right, listen, I got to jump because I got to get downtown for Yahoo.
All right. Well, let's plan next week.
Yeah, let's plan on next week, and I'll get my wife on the phone because she's much more savvy on the issues.
I've never talked to her. I'm sure I'll enjoy it.
You'll love her. Oh, yeah, she was a member of the New York Stock Exchange. That's where we met. She was one of the first Latina member of the New York Stock
Exchange.
Good for her. Yeah. She broke barriers, my wife.
So I was going to ask you if she was a fellow paisan, but she's not.
So she understands everything we're talking about.
Well, you know what? I love it. Well, next week's gonna be fun.
Yeah, perfect. It'll be great for her too, because she, you know, this is where she is now. She's thrown herself completely into this organization, and so she can rattle these numbers off and rattle off. You know, would have a great conversation.
Boy, she and Diane will be two peas in a pod.
Yeah, they'll be two peas in a pod. You and I could just step back and let them run with it.
Might be you and I will play online chess or something or checkers.
All right, I gotta jump.
Take care. Do we have Professor Hill?
Yes, we do.
Hey, what's up, bud? Is he zooming in the wrong spot, or where is he?
I'm working on some data. My colleague and I are looking at the effect of the opportunity zones on, I guess you could say, targeted industries at the county level from 2010 to 2023. And
I'm dying to find out what you find out there.
I was just running some code in Python.
What are those different than TIF zones, or what is the
opportunity thing? Zones are like investment credits. Like if you're an investor and you sell, I don't know, an asset and you want to hide the money from capital gains, You can move that into these opportunity zone funds. And that basically is a bank where you put your capital gains, your sales from your assets into this, effectively a bank. And then that bank makes loans to start new businesses. And they're set up in census tracts where it's predominantly like poor people and maybe people of color to spark startups and maybe expand businesses.
Is it tied in at all with the business opportunity zones where you get the different TIF zones? Is it tied in at all there or no?
Well, it's from the 2017 tax reform.
Oh, so no.
The opportunity zones were designated in 2018, and they were not changed. They have not changed at all since 2018. So we have a bunch of counties where they're in the quote-unquote treatment group, and they get a variable coded as one for all years in the data set from 2010 to 2023. And then the other counties that never got an OZ are always coded as zeros through time. And about 70% of our counties are opportunity zones, about 30% are not. I think it's 68, 32. So 38% or 72% have opportunity zones, 32% don't. And then we have a variable called pre and post, and it's a dummy variable that's ones and zeros for years from 2018 onward for all counties, and then zeros before. And then it sets up this difference in differences. And you see this method used a lot in experiments, right? But the difference between what we're doing and what a pharmaceutical company would do is they'd randomly assign people to the treatment group and people to the control group. And then they would give people in the control group the placebo, and they'd give people in the other group the
actual medicine. Can you do both if it's a TIF zone in a designated county? Can you do both?
Well, that kind of complicates it. That could be future research. But I think the next project we're going to do is we're going to look at the effect of ChatGPT and its rollout when people could use it for free starting December 2022, and we're going to look at that a kind of a before and after in the professional science and technology firm count census firm track. County level firm counts. We're going to look at that. And then at the same time, we're going to look at it in terms of employment.
Where do you get all this information?
Well, the Census Bureau has these text files. And if you were to open up one of these text files and you'd want to find your county in it, it'd probably take you an hour to do it, because you have all of the industry codes, you know, from services to construction, everything. It's really fine grain. And then you have overall like classified NAICS counties. You can go from, I think we're using year 2010 to 2023,
but I mean if somebody folded up, if somebody folded up
like Python, you have to use something like Python to stack it really nice and neatly in what's called a panel data
all right,
set.
What's Python?
Python is a programming language, a platform that is kind of like academics use data in R, where professionals use
Python. If Hale's Hot Dog Stand closes up tomorrow,
yeah,
how soon does it show up in this data that you're no longer there?
Probably the next year, because it's annual.
But so I mean, the census, how do they do all this stuff?
Well, they have an army, I guess, that goes out and counts these firms, I guess. And, you know, they go around and they count these things. And
well, for individuals, there's a 10-year thing, and then there's the really big long one they send you once or twice in your lifetime.
Yeah, that's the census. Yeah, that's the personal census. But this is the firm count. It's called County Business Patterns.
Okay. And yeah. is this funded by the federal government or by somebody else?
Federal government, Census Bureau. Yeah, it's really fascinating because they have the firm counts not just by industry. Sorry. They have it by number of employees. So it's going to be really interesting to see, I think, in the professional scientific and technology industry codes, if the number of firms increases for firms with small numbers of employees.
I don't think we've ever
decreases for firms with large number of employees in that industry code, at the moment that ChatGPT is rolled out and these tech firms, I think what's happening is these tech firms, instead of hiring a bunch of young college students that have computer science degrees or business analytics degrees or whatnot, economists, they're just having an experienced guy that's been there for 5 years, instead of having him or her manage a team of first-year hires right out of college, entry-level workers, they're actually having them run AI. So you, what you might see is in this industry code, you might see a huge uptick in the number of smaller firms and then a huge down drop, a cliff in the number of large firms.
Well, how do they, I guess, how do they get this in? I've been involved, well, I've known people that own law firms and accounting firms.
But
I don't know a soul who's ever gotten anything from the census on the business side.
Yeah, the federal government's got an army of statisticians and economists walking around and taking down information, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, I don't think there's ever a form we've gotten.
No, yeah.
Somebody's counting us going in the door or what? Maybe.
This data is actually used a lot by researchers. So, and the bad thing about the data is in 2017, the census had a change in the way they classify firms. They had like a confidentiality issue. And so what you see is in counties that are really small, rural in population, and they have very few firms, you see all of a sudden a cliff where things just drop off a cliff, literally, from 2016 to 2017. And it's just because the census changed the way it counts firms. And so what we need to do to overcome that is we could lift the trend artificially, or we could just take the ratio of the industries that we're interested in. Like, we're interested in about 5 service sectors and construction, because that's where most of this money goes, these OZ funds go. And we can divide that by the overall firm count from the county. And we can do that by size of firm. And that would cancel out the cliff drops.
How do you zeroing in on firms where a lot of people they hire, I'm not saying they're paying every cash off the books, but they're probably 1099 employees. How the hell do you count them? They don't know the end of the year.
That's the nastiness of economic research. The data's imperfect. And what you're looking for is, I don't think the levels matter much, like presidential polling. I don't think the levels matter. It's the direction the polls are going. I think that's what matters. It's the trend.
Well, you're saying, what you're saying, and this is not professor language, is whatever mistakes you're making, you're making them the same way, so the trend should tell you something. Isn't that about the summary?
I mean, if you saw what I've seen in articles that I've read, even in top journals, I'm like thinking, this is either the worst written article I've ever read, and it's in a top journal, or the person doing it really doesn't have an idea about how dirty this data is. And the United States, I think the data is less dirty here than it is in like South America or
Africa. Yeah. So I think it's less dirty than in Europe, though. I think they're better.
It's kind of like you know, the fiat currencies of the world. The dollar is the least bad.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of which, what do you make of this slide in these the last couple of weeks in the crypto stuff? I mean, I used to not worry about it, you know, but now I hear and know about it. We don't do any of this at PTI. Although, get a load of this. Talk about it. It might be the slide to the top. The guy who tends bar at the Tripoli on Tuesday night. This younger guy. He's from Guatemala. He's got 2-3 jobs. Nice guy. Nice family and a whole bit. And he tells me, "Chief, you guys do anything in crypto?" And of course, the hair goes up in the back of my neck, right? And I go, "We don't really trade much." Well, I got like $1,000. I want to pile into crypto. And I said, "James, what do you know about crypto? I know it's going up, but all my buddies are in it and tell me I should be in it." I go, "So in other words, you don't know anything about it." I said, "Plus, I don't know that much about it either, so I'm not criticizing you." I said, "But it's kind of like an artificial stock. I mean, but it's going up. And I'm going, "Oh, boy." I mean, this is exactly what, talk about a momentum trader right out of the gate. And now since he's made this conversation, it's done nothing but go straight down. I used to think there was not enough money in, there's a lot in there, but I didn't think there was enough money in the crypto world, when I say I used to, I'm talking 5-6 years ago, where if there was a problem, it was gonna, it really couldn't cause a problem in like the regular market or in the currency markets or something. But now, I think these guys are up to $2 or $3 trillion in stuff in there, and there's margining on it and so forth. The headline here is that Ether falls following a multi-million dollar hack of a decentralized finance protocol. If, as you know, I'm a doubting sort of dude from the south side. I don't buy at all that these things are unhackable and that this Bitcoin is purer than Pharaoh's wife. The idea that somebody could have 50 grand in there, forget his number, and 100 years from now, the 50 grand's still waiting for him to go come get it. Hey, I'm too old of a dog to be screwed like that. I mean, if somebody's going to find it.
Well, I think there's going to be an AI supercomputer that is going to be able to read everything a person ever wrote and every situation the person's in eventually.
Why would you want to read everything I ever wrote?
Well, it's probably going to be able to hack that maybe in 50 years would be easier than today.
My question is, without doubling into whether it's good or bad, if there's, if all of a sudden these things drop by 50%, I think they're big enough now. This is just one man's opinion. I'm asking a question because I don't know anything about it, because we don't trade it or anything. If it drops 40-50%, I think it's going to have a hit on the rest of the investments, meaning the market and other stuff. I don't know about the bonds, but I think it's going to cause a problem. I think it's a big issue in so many smaller countries. I think it's going to cause some currency fluctuations, don't you think? I mean, I guess my question is, how big of a problem do you think it could be? Is my question.
I think the bigger like Bitcoin goes, the bigger the market gets, the higher it goes, just indicates how much inflation central banks have created in the last 10, 15 years. That's really what it is. Just a super amount of liquidity injected into the system.
Well, it's gone from 126 to 103 now in about 3 weeks.
Yeah, I mean,
the question is how can we tell? I mean, I can tell you, well, I can go to the FINRA site, and I can tell you how much margin is on listed stocks. That firms like, well, PTI doesn't loan you the money, RBC would. That firms are lending to people for stock. And that number has got me very afraid. It's up like $50 billion a month for the last 5 months. And it's an all-time record. It's well over a trillion something. And that's really high. That's a problem. Matter of fact, last Friday, I was at the local traders bar here, just doing research. And one of the people at the next table was with a firm talking about how many margin calls they had when Meta was down $75. I go, you gotta be kidding me. I mean, you got margin. I think people are margined to the max on some of this stuff. I mean, the thing of it is, PTI is such an unusual firm. We do protective stuff for people. We've got regular people that do their own stuff, but they're all real conservative people. I don't think we've ever had anybody in the 35 years that maybe we might have somebody, my brother, know better than me. Buy me 1,000 shares of IBM, $300, and by the way, I'll send you 150. We've never, I don't think we've ever had anybody like that. I mean, we've got to be the only firm in the world that has a positive cash balance type of thing. That's why clearing firms
better watch out. The SEC might come after you.
Well, I mean, no, what I'm saying, we don't have, it's not the people we attract. So I don't really have a feel other than looking at the
number. There was a bank in Boston, I remember reading about it during the financial crisis, where they had like 40 or 50% reserves. And I think regulators came looking at it because they had what was considered too many reserves. So,
well, I mean, you wonder.
Kind of like when you take $10,000 into a bank and you want to deposit in a checking account.
Well, there's two sides of the balance sheet. And how I learned this, Sal? Believe it or not, my stepfather was involved. He and another guy, and then there was this wacky guy named Barney that actually sat there. There was a credit union, St. John Fisher, and they ran the credit union. And what people don't, unless you're in the business, and it's such a simple business, credit unions, I mean, you brought your money up there, and they paid you 3.5%. So one night, I'm sitting there, and I couldn't have been more than 15 years old. I'm BSing with Barney, and he goes, yeah, we're paying 3.5%. He goes, we better get a few more loans at 6.5%, or we're not going to be able to pay the 3.5%. I mean, that's what banks do, right? They're a financial intermediary.
That's why the credit unions back I think a couple years after the financial crisis, Bank of America was given 30-year mortgages, fixed-rate mortgages, but credit unions weren't. They were given 15.
Yeah.
And it's because they got to worry about that, right?
Well, yeah. And
they got to worry about being upside down, where Bank of America can always just, hey, Fed, I need some money.
Well, you can, since people don't pay they don't pay a lot of interest. Some banks are paying more now. They didn't pay a lot of interest for a long time. I mean, people would deposit money, and you're not getting any money, right? Okay. But the whole idea of a bank...
And we also know how friendly the Fed is to credit unions and savings loans, right?
Well,
they crushed them.
Oh, yeah, they crushed them. But, you know, I mean, if you were to ask a normal person now, when I say normal, somebody who's 30, 35 years old, and you'd say, what does a bank do? I don't think most people could write out 100... Most people can't write anything out 100 words anymore. 100 words, what does a bank do? Well, a bank is an intermediary, because people who have ideas, need a house, need an asset, are building something, they need cash. Cash is a factor of production like anything else. You need steel, you need concrete, you need electrical wiring, and oh, by the way, you need cash to pay for it. That's how you build a building. Now, the people who have the excess money that are working, are saving, they have the dough, and other people need the cash. So what you do is you take the money from the people who have the extra, ma and pa, put in 100 hours
a
week.
That's how it's designed.
You pay them for the use of the money.
That's how it's supposed to work.
That's how it's supposed to work.
And but I don't think it works like that anymore.
But the further you get away from the principal, the further you get away from how it's supposed to work, then it doesn't work, right?
Yeah.
So the idea is the guy who's building the building pays you 6.5% because he's planning on making 10%, and hope he does. Or he or she, and the person that has the money at their home, you're paying them 3.5 or 4. And by the way, the 1 or 2 or 3% in the middle, it pays for the building, pays for the people, pays for the Little League uniforms, and everybody's happy. That's the way it's supposed to work, right?
Yeah.
And now we can't. We got all kinds of different ways. You know, we're gonna do this. We're gonna siphon off the money for like one or two big projects.
Well, now banks just park money in the Federal Reserve System and earn interest on reserves. They're lending the money to the Fed, or they park it in the repo market, right? They park it there.
But if you have a firm that's paying 4 or 5% on their CDs, they can't do that because they have guys that are willing to pay them, you know, 7.5% because they're building a factory.
Yeah.
You know, because, there's only so much you can get from the Fed. The only firms that do that are little tiny firms. That's where you get in trouble with this. Did we talk about it last week? Or was it where if you and I, you could have started, I actually did some research on this, Al, because somebody wanted to start a bank on the South Side. And I ran
good luck with that.
Well, I ran to these guys in a Sox game one night, and they were bank entrepreneurs. And they go, $1.5 million, this is 10 years ago, it's probably $4 million now. He goes, you can start a bank. Yourself a storefront. Put a name out there and put it next to, you know, people make deposits, all insured. Get some people that they hire from maybe the bank they used to use, and you're gonna do fine. You're going to get all these deposits. He says, it's going to be a long time before you have a car loan department. He says, but you send that money off to the Fed or somebody, and you make a little bit as you build up your deposit base. And now what happens is these big banks come by and they say, we've got a portfolio of loans that are paying 7%. How about buying into that? Well, you don't have a loan department, so you say, okay, Citigroup, I'll buy into your, you know, HAL 444 loan portfolio. And then you buy into that. Well, that's what happens when one of those goes. It takes a lot of these little banks with it because they're the investors, because they don't have... I mean, it'd be a long time before you and I opened up a bank where we're going to lend somebody $40 million for a building. That's our entire deposit base. We can't do that.
If you're trying to start a new bank, the way you get depositors is you have to pay an interest rate that's higher than what Bank of America is going to pay. Right?
Well, you do a little bit, yeah. But also, in the South Side, two or three banks got taken over. This is 20 years ago, you know, and they got taken over to First National Bank, which was my bank, of Evergreen Park. And they got taken over by... talk about a story. They got taken over by Old Kent. It was Ozinga with the concrete people. They were the big owners of the bank. The second biggest owner was a guy who owned Bleeker's Bowling Alley. All of a sudden, he gets this huge check, basically, when he took over his bank. The guy has a grabber the next day and dies. The day he became rich. And so and they got bought out by Fifth Third. Well, my mother and a bunch of old people use that bank all the time. They canned all their, you know, the checkers and the cashiers and so forth. Somebody opened up a tiny little bank on 95th Street, got a storefront, and everybody moved their money down there. All these old ladies moved their money down
there. It's probably because you don't get very good service at, like,
right,
big bank, right?
Right. Well, the same thing happened to Beverly Bank. They opened up a storefront right next to the Rock Island Station, and within 2 years, they built their own building. That's how well they did. Like, wow. 8 people. It was like the same checkout ladies that people used in Beverly Bank for 100 years. They went in there, and everybody goes, I'm not going to that new place. I'm going to this place.
It's like an old diner with the women that have been working as wait staff for 20 years, like Flo and Alice. You know, people like them. And so that business is successful because people like the workers that are friendly to them at this diner, you know? So I can see that. You know, you mentioned First National Bank, right?
Yeah.
When I was in the Navy station in Idaho where I taught nuclear power operations, there was a building, an old building in downtown Old Town Pocatello, Idaho, and it was called First National Bank. It wasn't a bank. It was a bar that I used to hang out in.
Because I was saying, if it's First National Bank, it's of some place. Because the First National Bank of Chicago, every town had a First National Bank or something.
Yeah, but it was a bar, and it was a great bar because you'd have the best live music in southeastern Idaho play there. It was really good music.
Did they have an ATM with a Bitcoin machine in there at least?
Well, they didn't have a Bitcoin machine because that was like back in the days when I banked at First National Bank.
Oh, God. Hey, we got to go to break, bud. And then you can tell us why this market's down so much. The S&P futures down 78. The S&P futures down 402. That's a lot. Be right back, Stacks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Hello, don't bank Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom. Ricky on the board. S&P futures down 78. Yeah, it's like the lows we've seen it. NASDAQ futures down 405. They tried to get back. We're only down 60 a few minutes ago, and now we've dipped again. Dow futures down 285. Big numbers here. Palantir's down 16. That's 8%. That's at earnings last night. We've got, see what else. We got NVIDIA down 475, but that's what was up yesterday. Apple's down 243. Microsoft down 440. Amazon down 480. So pretty much everything across the board here is down. Over in Europe, we've got sell-off here as well. DAX down 281, that's 1.2%. FTSE only down 38, they're only down 0.4%, so they're hanging in there. CAC around down 82, that's a full 1%, so the DAX is the worst there. Over in Asia, Nikkei down 914, 1.7%, but they're still 51.5, they're still pretty high. Hang Seng down 205, that's 0.8%. Shanghai down 16.4, so not horrible over there. Oil down 80 cents, 60.25, again, right near the 60 number. I'd say we were near 63 forever, now we're at 60 forever, so we've seen them drop the range about $3. Brent down 76 cents, 64.13. We got gold down again, but only down $13 at 4,000, 4,000 exactly. Silver down 66 cents, 47.38, so gold was 4,300, so it's taken about an 8% haircut from the high. Foreign exchange, dollar's actually up, but the euro is at one. Is under 115, 114.92. That's the lowest we've seen. It was 117, I'm going to say, 3-4 weeks ago. So that's a over 2% move. That's a lot of currency. British pound, 130. British pound was 135. Again, these are big moves. Crypto, here's where a lot of the problem is, I think. Bitcoin's down 2,700, 103,898. But Ether is down 7%, was down 7%. It's only down 2% now. There was some kind of a hack that they discovered, but it's back only being down 2%. Yeah, bad stuff. What do you got for us, Ricky? Traffic, weather, sports.
Morning, Chief. It's currently 7:35 here in Chicago. We're looking at 43 degrees right now with a high of 61. Partly sunny and pleasant, and that will be clear and breezy with a low of 51 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 60 degrees right now with a high of 91. Very warm with plenty of sunshine. Tonight, clear with a low of 60 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, 20 minutes. Looking at Kennedy from Monroe's. Edens from Lane Cook, 33 minutes. We're looking at 34 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf. Dan Ryan from 95th, 29 minutes. And lastly, Stevenson from 294. episode of Dan Ryan, 46 minutes. 76ers are Bulls is today at 8 p.m. And we also have Sunset Warriors for the NBA at 10 p.m. Lastly, NFL Sunday, the Bears beat Bengals 47-42. And this Thursday, we have Raiders at Broncos, 8:15 p.m. Back to you guys.
When you see earnings come out, like a Palantir and some of these things, and these things are I'm going to say they're on regular stuff, you would look at earnings per share and revenue per share, they're way ahead of themselves. But that doesn't mean that they aren't properly priced. If they're actually going to go where people think they're going to go, my concern always has been, in any individual stock, they could very well get there. Who knows? They could be sitting on a silver mine, for God's sake. But it's hard for, you know, 10 of them to have quadruple revenues in the next 4 years without the rest of the country growing. And to me, there's always a yin and a yang there. And I don't think they can all grow as fast as they said they're going to grow, because I don't think the rest of the people got the scratch, to be honest with you. Is that a fair assessment, or am I just looking at two different things the wrong way?
Well, I think what's really going on is what the Fed is doing. If you look at the spread in the interest on reserves rate and what's called the secured overnight financing rate, I think they're kind of the same. The IOR is the price control for bank reserves, and there is an equivalent in the repo market. And I think what's going on is the IOR rate, and I've mentioned this before, is when inflation starts to bubble up and it starts to accelerate, which we're seeing with M2 money growth.
We're seeing it, everything you buy, for God's sake.
Yeah, when that happens, the only thing that the Fed can really do is raise these floors, raise the floors to keep the reserves in the repo market and in the bank reserves market, the federal funds market. It has to raise these floors to keep that money trapped in there. And what's going on now is, I think what's happening is IOR rate is too low. The rate that the Fed sets to keep reserves trapped in the banking system, where banks want to lend to the Fed at this rate, right? That's too low. And so you're seeing this huge demand in repo. And so the rate in the repo market is no longer binding. And so I think what the Fed has to do is it either has to raise IOR, or it has to add liquidity to the repo market. If it adds liquidity to the repo market, if it increases the supply of reserves in the repo market, it will, with demand being downward sloping, that will pull that rate down. So it's got to add liquidity, or it's got to raise these rates. And the Fed doesn't want to do that, because the current president will, freak out, like all presidents would.
Well, the problem is you need to have a president that has, you know, kind of an ounce of brains. I don't know if we're ever going to get one of those. But,
well, I don't think we're going to ever get one of those.
Right. Well, I mean, in August,
they have interest that they need to be served. All of them do, and none of them want the Fed to raise rates on them. They want the Fed, all these presidents and these Treasury secretaries, Democrat or Republican, want these lower rates. And the problem with that is it creates inflation, because these reserve escape.
Well, nobody wants it, because they think there's this quid pro quo, and they're really sort of, I think, at the edges. I mean, the idea that you're going to lower the rate from 1.2 to 1.
If they keep lowering these rates, I think there's going to be more reserves flooding out of the system, because the banks aren't going to lend the Fed at 3.5.
But
they're going to lend to somebody else.
I'm asking the professor here. This is from my my feel. All right, if your federal funds rate, let's say the short term interest rate, is 4%, and you drop it from 4 to 3.5. Or raise it.
What bank would want to do that? What bank would want to hold the reserves with the Fed, right?
No, but I'm saying,
if they want to lend it to somebody else.
I know, but if the rate's 4 and you drop it to 3.25, or you raise it to 4.75, I think you can have somewhat of an idea of what's going on. I mean, you can change with a lag time of 6 months. It used to be, people used to think it was anyway. You can change sort of little lending practices. You can change some decisions that people are making on projects or not. But there's a whole flow through to this, and I think a lot of the people who bleat constantly on TV about it couldn't let you know what the flow through is if their life depended on it. They just yep. But I think when you get to the point where you're 1.25, and you drop it to 1, I don't know. It's like putting it's like going to pee in Lake Michigan to fill it up. I mean, you're so far at the edge. I'm not so sure that going from 12% to 12.25% back in 1980 did any good either. I mean, you're so. I mean, I guess what I'm saying, pal, is that at the extremes, I don't know that the policy even does any good. You know what I'm saying?
But what I know is, if they keep lowering this rate, banks aren't going to keep their money in the with the Fed at that lower rate. They're going to want to lend it to somebody else. And so when that happens, lending picks up, and lending, as we know, multiplies. When that money is lent out to like General Motors buys something. Well, now that person they bought it from has more cash and they put it in the bank. And so that bank now has more reserves and they lend it out. They're not going to keep this money trapped in the banking system. So the way you keep the reserves from escaping and causing more inflation is these rates have to be raised. And, or they have to add liquidity to make them binding again. So you either have to raise the rates or you have to add liquidity. And what that does, it creates even more fuel for future inflation.
Well, I think what we're starting to see, and I don't know if we have any president, when these guys started dropping the rates, it was in September, all right? So the rate was 4.3, and now we're at, 4.1?
That's kind of when this spread really kind of took off.
Okay.
It really took off.
What I'm saying is, if you look at the 10-year, the 10-year is actually up since before they dropped it, the short term, twice.
Yeah.
So what you end up having is exactly what you just said. If this is the direction you're going and you're pouring more money into the system and it's going to cause inflation, not to mention the tariffs on top of it, you could end up with, if Trump has his way, a 3% federal funds rate and a 5.5% 10-year.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what you don't want to have happen. Right?
Well, I think you want the yield curve to be upward sloping.
Not to that extent.
What you don't want to be doing is See, the problem with the Fed is they have these geniuses at the Fed who think they have all the information in the world and can plan the economy from D.C., where they meet, every 6 weeks. And they set these floors in repo and in bank reserves. They set these floors, and right now, the one floor is non-binding. The other floor is, I think IOR is binding still. But the other floor is not binding. And the only way you get it to be binding again is by doing what you don't want to do. Add reserves to the repo market. If you add to the supply in the repo market with demand downward sloping, that will pull that secured overnight financing rate down toward its floor. So you're seeing a huge shift into the repo market. And the repo market interest rate floor that the Fed has imposed is not binding. The demand is so great that it's no longer binding. That's what's pushing that rate
up. But they somehow or another, like I say, it's somehow I buried my educational background, and I don't know why some...
Well, this stuff didn't exist when you were in school.
Sure
it didn't exist when I was in my PhD
program.
It
absolutely did.
No, the interest on reserves rate, this price floor... in the federal funds market and this price floor in the repo market, that didn't exist.
That's all a total dodge to get away from the real number, and the real number is how much money's in the system.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a total dodge.
They're trying to keep it trapped in there with these interest rates, but the Fed is lowering them instead of raising them because what's happening is there's so much snow melt in the mountains of the Rocky Mountains that the water from the snow melt is overtopping the dam.
And
that becomes inflation.
But somehow we don't teach or we don't listen or nobody does. I mean, that's why they don't want you or me in there.
Well, I think what happens to these big universities, the professors aren't teachers, they're researchers. And they're probably still teaching that old model that predates the monetary model that predates 2008. Probably still teaching that.
But here's when somebody... we're talking about repos. We have all these bizarre things we're doing.
Yeah.
And the simple fact is, okay, why when Hal loans $1,000 to the chief, what's the nature of that transaction? Does anybody even know what that is anymore?
I think people in this system that benefit from it, they want to make it so convoluted and complex and use all kinds of fancy language and skew the rules and price controls this, price controls that, caps, floors, that most people just say, I'm not even worried about it. I'm gonna go to work. I'm gonna earn my money and pay my rent.
But I'm saying, how many people that are sitting in the room quizzing the Fed chief could say what you and I are just about to say? When
honestly, I don't think Powell really understands this.
I don't think he does either.
Yeah, I don't. Honestly,
they don't. But I mean, but the nature of any kind.
I think Powell and Trump suffer from hubris. I mean, they think they know better.
Well,
and I don't think either one knows the consequences of what they're doing.
But when I just said about the 10-year versus the other.
Yeah.
Below that is, and I always go to the individual. Like today, we're talking about the psychologists and the veterans. How many times you have to see somebody? How many times? What does it cost per visit? That's just me, and I know that's so outmoded now that, you know, it's like the buggy whip or the roll down windows in your car or something. But simple fact is, when you lend me $1,000, you're gonna want there's some return for me using your money. There's a cost to that. Now what is that cost? That's known as the real rate of interest. What is the cost based on how many people want to borrow money, based on how many people are willing to lend it? The real rate of interest is somewhere between 2.5 and 3.25, and it has been there for centuries.
Yeah.
I mean, now, but on top of that, if you sense, hey, these bozos got a 10% inflation going here, if I lend you $1,000, at the end of the year, you got to give me $1,100 just for me to break even because of the way. Yeah. So your real rate of interest, the nominal rate of interest is going to be the real rate, what you're charging me for the money, plus the anticipated inflation if there is any.
Yep. Yeah.
This is so simple, and everything falls off that, right? You think any of these people could even explain that?
I don't think they can. You know, the funny thing about it is, do people in the bottom 50% actually have to save? I mean, there's a lot of disincentives to savings. Everything within our government policy, with Fed policy and with fiscal policy, is set up to get people to use debt to be good little consumers. What did George Bush say after 9/11? Hey, nothing to see here. He's like Officer Barbary or Frank Drebin, right? Officer Barbary in South Park or Frank Drebin in Naked Gun. Nothing to see here. Everybody go home. Return to your home. Be good little consumers. Nothing to see here. They want us to be good little consumers, so the people in D.C. and Wall Street are the beneficiaries of that. They want this type of economy where all the benefits of fiscal and monetary policy accrue to a very small number of people. And you know, building out my history of economic theory course, I put myself in Marx's shoes, Karl Marx. This is going to be controversial. I don't think very many people do this, but Karl Marx grew up at a time, it was like 20, 30 years maybe after the guilds lost all their power. But the guilds, you have a guild master running basically a labor union, but the guild master was a seller of the guild members' labor. And unlike a labor union, which tries to get the highest the firm's willing to pay for a scarce supply of labor, the guild master is doing the opposite. They're paying the worker in their guild the reservation wage of the marginal worker, and they're taking that surplus, and that's the surplus that Marx was talking about. And then the firms, this guy is selling his labor to a monopoly buyer of labor, the one factory town. So the factory owner and the guild master are stealing the surplus of the workers. The workers have no worker surplus. Worker surplus is the difference between the rate that you are paid in the market minus the rate that you would work at in minimum, right? Your reservation wage. And Marx referred to the reservation wage as poverty rate or the subsistence rate.
That's what workers are getting paid. What he missed out on, I think, if we could clone him and get him alive today, what he missed out on is anytime you have inflation, you are absolutely screwing the worker.
This whole structure is not capitalism. This is corporatism. Well, his book should have been called DOS corporatism.
Right. Well, what do you think we're
not
doing?
Not capitalism. He wasn't a critique of
what do you think?
Market voluntary exchange economy.
What do you think we're doing right now?
He was really critical of state corporatism.
What do you
of
think?
Of the licensing of these privileges that are granting these grandsons of nobles and landowners and aristocrats. That is a system he was really critiquing.
What do you think we're doing right now? It's
exactly
our system.
I think if Marx grew up in this world today, he would be outraged with the Republicans and the Democrats.
Oh,
I
honestly think
he was really about the government issuing all these protections and privileges and licenses and restrictions to make a very few number of people who are connected politically very wealthy at the expense of the worker. So I think in actuality he was probably more of a radical libertarian.
Now, even if you had when I was doing the stuff at Pullman, even if you had escalation clauses in everybody's labor contract, which nobody has anymore, right? But
no.
if you did, at the very least, if the prices are going up 1% a month, you don't get your pay raise till the next month.
Yep, exactly. Even
if it's a perfect system where the CPI number was correct, which we know it's not, and if everybody actually had an escalation clause, even if you did, you're a month behind and you're getting screwed.
Yeah.
And that's if it was perfect. And we're so far from perfect. I mean, look at the ACE. Well,
yeah, and over time, it compounds.
But people, you know,
that gap grows geometrically because of compounding.
Well, even at the risk of me being myself again, which is, you know, a pain in the ass even for me, Audrey and I go to this Thai restaurant, right? And the food's delicious.
The food's delicious.
Oh, you like? Oh, yeah. But I mean, the food's delicious. The lady goes out and buys it fresh every morning. I mean,
by the way, never challenged the cook herself about making it hot as a Thai person can stand.
Oh, no. They always
do. Take that as a challenge.
Oh, yeah. You can't do that. Otherwise, you're liable to not be able to feel your tongue for about 4 days.
Well, it's the next day when it comes out of the other part of your body.
Well, that's a problem. Yeah, it's an issue. God. Anyway, so the I didn't want to say anything because I'm not going to, you know, be an economics knucklehead in a Thai restaurant. Yeah. But all the prices are up. This is when COVID, you know, was doing its thing. Well, they're up now again. Or the last time we went there, and the guy said something effective. Well, I can't believe the cook quit. You know, we took him from $15 an hour to like 18, and I'm sitting there, I almost barfed up my wine. Let me get this straight. I should have said, every item on the menu is up $3. The guy probably pumps out, I'm going to say, 40 dinners an hour or 30 dinners?
Yeah.
I mean, what are those guys can do? I said, so his benefit to you now is up, in a busy hour, is up $110, and you offered him a $3 raise. but if I were, he wouldn't have known what I was talking about.
No.
I mean, and even so, the prices have been going up for 6 months, and you finally offered the guy a raise, and by the way, he left anyway, you know, because you didn't offer him enough.
Well, he probably got an offer from he probably got 20% raise by just changing employers.
Yeah, but I mean, people talk about the labor, to lack of a better term, is never going to catch up. There's only one time, and I don't want to go into this too deep because we don't have that much time. So only one time, if somebody would ask me, and I don't know of anybody who's got more hands-on inflation stuff than me, because that's what I did when I got out of school for a long time. The only time, Carl, that there actually was a wage push inflation was maybe, I'm going to say, 6 months, I forget what year it was, 1980, 1979, somewhere in there. And what happened there was, for whatever reason, the CPI, even if you do it properly, which we don't do it now, we you know, are they running the numbers by the Oval Office now? I don't know. It's getting that bad. But for whatever reason, there's always a delay. Say it's a 4-6 month delay, a lag. I'll use the term lag in the CPI, and I don't know why, because you're supposed to be doing it every month. But let's say it is. So you're always going to have inflation before it shows up, and when you if you actually quote lick it. You're going to still show it for a few months. Well, there was a time there where the inflation was still percolating through the system, and it was pretty obvious to everybody that it's stuff had stopped going up. So for that 4 to 6 month time frame, and since people had escalation clauses, you probably actually were getting raises that were not justified. Now, of course, they weren't catching up for the past 15 years, but for those 4 to 6 months, you actually were getting wages that were not justified. So companies actually probably were having their wages go up higher than they could raise their prices. That's the only time in my lifetime that I could say there actually was wage push inflation.
Yeah.
And
well, I wouldn't consider wage pushing. I don't consider rising wages as inflation. What I consider inflation is just the excessive money growth in the money supply.
Well, okay, but I'm saying
I don't consider, you know, a supply shock inflationary. I don't consider increased demand for a product inflationary.
No, it isn't.
What's inflationary is the excessive growth of the money supply.
Well, you know, I'm reaching a point now, you know, when I actually just, Audrey had some work done at her house, and of course I know the guys were doing the work, so they don't like going to the store, so I shoot out early and I go back. Well, I ended up, I get sent to the store because they were making sure gutters were all attached, and you got to use those little self-tapping screws, right?
Yeah.
So I go to the Home Depot and I get a half inch and a 5/8 inch, the tiny little pack. Guess how much?
I don't know, $20?
$22,
wow.
And I'm sitting there, I can put these in my pocket. This is now 2 hours work at minimum wage.
Mm.
We're at the point where money for nothing and your chicks for free. Money's worth nothing. Go to a bar now, buy, you see these guys downstairs, they'll buy like, the company will come in, they'll buy like, 20 shots or something and put them on a tray. It's what? It's $200?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a bottle and a half of booze.
Yeah.
I mean, what are we? You might as well burn it at this point. And some people have so much of it, they don't care. I think I never did this, but nobody would even snort Coke through a $100 bill. It's almost like a chump change now. When are we getting a $500 bill? The $100 bill isn't going anywhere.
I wanted to go to the Washington State. Washington State's playing in Virginia twice this year. They played at UVA, and then they're going to play at James Madison, JMU.
What league are they in now, Washington State?
They're still in the Tupac.
Oh, God. So when's that going to change? Next year?
Next year. That's going to be the Pac-9 in basketball, Pac-8 in football. They're adding Gonzaga as a basketball member.
Yeah. Okay.
But right, they're playing this year, and I wanted to go. I go to JMU's website, and they want to sell me a $100 ticket. And the Cougars are like 4-5. And I'm like, I'm not doing that. You know, I can't afford that. So I'm not going. I'd like to go, but I've been looking at VetTix. VetTix is a place where people who buy tickets, they donate them to this, nonprofit who then provides the tickets basically for free with a fee, like a $10 fee. And you can buy tickets that way, but JMU's not. There's no JMU WSU tickets on that site yet.
Well, so. not only have they raised the price of
tickets. I don't know how people go to these sporting events, honestly.
Even the they raised the price of the tickets where a lot of people can't afford it. But the secondary market, even if it's a blizzard coming, by the time you go through StubHub or somebody, you're paying a premium on a day when nobody wants to go. I mean, but between the money they get, it's impossible just about now for somebody to say, I got two tickets for sale and you to buy them from the guy. You can't. There are no tickets, and I don't think you can transfer them without going through one of these places.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
You know, the even worse is the movie theaters. The movie theaters complain about nobody's going to the movie theater. Well, when you charge $20 for a ticket in Burlington, North Carolina, and you got a family of six, who in the right mind is going to go to the freaking movie theater?
Yeah, you can't. It's crazy.
And then if you go, because it's like a Wednesday and it's low demand day and they sell the tickets for $7, the popcorn is still $15.
Yeah, if we had a department store, hell, you and I want to be the cashier in like the Gucci aisle or something, because they're doing fine. I mean, there's people who have so much money now, they don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's absolutely incredible. I mean, I was looking at one of my attorney buddies was telling
you
me.
You know, Hollywood's complaining about no movies being produced or a reduction of movies, and there's layoffs in Hollywood. Do you think it has anything to do with the fact that for a family of six to go to the movies, it's going to be about $140?
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with that, but they're not about to.
Yeah. I mean, why not just cut the price in half, you, if you cut the prices in half, this is an elasticity argument. If you cut the prices in half, maybe the quantity demanded doesn't increase by, doesn't double. Maybe it quadruples. In that regard, revenues are going to go up.
Well, they still have, you know, old people Wednesday and Thursday during the day or something that some of the places here do.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's very rare now. Most of the time when you take a family out, you're gonna spend on the tickets and the popcorn and the drinks. You're spending $5 for a drink. I mean, come on.
Well, also one of the issues that if I was a nobody ever want me in the Oval Office.
The marginal cost of a soda is like pennies.
Yeah.
Why do I know that? Because at McDonald's they sell all sizes for $1.49, which means the marginal increase in that price, that difference in price is zero divided by zero.
The cup costs more than the soda. You know that.
Yeah. So charging $5 for a freaking soda, if you cut that in half, you could maybe increase ticket sales at your theater by 10%.
Well, one of the highest profit items in our lifetime today. It's probably, maybe it's back to number one. Actually, probably not. Back to one or two. Is movie popcorn.
Yeah. Yep.
But
just cut that in half. If you cut the popcorn in half and the soda in half,
it's all about a captive audience. It's all about.
They have a monopoly.
Once you're in the door, it's like, why do the Cubs get to charge $14 for a beer?
Yeah.
I mean, come on. I mean, because you're there, what are you going to do? You can't. If you walk across the street and get one, you can't come back in, right? I mean,
if you're gonna have monopoly prices on the concessions, how about lower the barrier to enter the monopoly? Lower the ticket price. Right?
Well, but I mean, they obviously, part of the issue, and I don't know. I could probably get elected president. The problem is, if I did, I'd bring all you guys with me, and nobody'd want you guys.
The CIA would have us all Gitmo, wouldn't they?
But I mean, I don't. When I go out to a nice place for dinner, I don't do that much anymore. But I don't. Once in a while, I'll entertain a client. But Audrey and I go out in the South Side, and it's just regular people. But if you go to a Chicago Cut or Gibson's or someplace, it bothers the bejesus out of me that I'm paying the full amount, and somebody next to me is writing it off.
Yeah.
That whole mix. The difference in price between a place where, it's a corporate place is the 30% difference that you can write off, basically, right?
Yeah.
If you were to go to a Cub game now, I think you would find that, maybe not in the upper deck, where the great unwashed are, where I used to be. I love that term, the great unwashed.
I was in the top row during the summer at that Yankee game where the kid from Cal State threw a no-hitter into the eighth inning. I was on the very top row. And it was great because I got the breeze off the East River. Awesome.
Were you sitting next to Bob Uecker? Bob Uecker seats?
I was. You could hear me up there. I was the only guy in the section. I was up on the last row.
But I'm going to say that 50, 60% of the seats now. My buddy Dr. J was with Ricketts one day, and Ricketts was telling him that something like 65% of the people in the park did not buy their own ticket. Mm. It was a corporate ticket, or it was a friend gave them to somebody. People have them, they give them away, or whatever it is. Because you're not, if you don't, and if they're, they're deductible to a certain, so they're
getting a group discount, plus they're getting the write off.
Well, I don't think you're getting a group discount. I never got one. We had four tickets forever. We never got a discount.
Well, no, if you're buying 100 tickets on a corporate rate.
I'm talking about the company has four tickets, or the company has that kind of a thing. Individuals, or if it's an individual, it's really a group of 20 individuals that buy them and then they split them up. They don't get a write off, but it's like anything else. I know a lot of people have. We got a dash here. All right, maybe I'll save this one for next week. So how many people in this country have construction, do construction work, do stuff for people, are painters that don't have a corporation, and yet they have to, where their tax, all their medical expenses would be a write-off to the corporation, and it's not to them personally. How many people don't even, I won't say take advantage of the law, but get screwed by the law?
Yeah.
Anyway,
I think this is why Marx was railing against the administrative state of Germany and Prussia.
Well, how many? I mean, I know you're on the right side of the aisle a little bit, but how many right wingers will rail at somebody like me who's in the middle and say, "You're not a capitalist. You're this. You're that." Does anybody describe what's going on here now as being free market capitalism?
I think the word capitalism is so abused, you don't want to use it anymore. Capitalism conjures images of some guy that is just cronied up the government with all kinds of privileges and licenses. And
well, my definition of capitalism is competitive capitalism, which would be your farmers, your
free exchange.
Well, free exchange, like it was on the CBOE floor when I was there. Talk about free market capitalism, but that's nothing now. That's 20% of the
capitalism to Marx and capitalism today is state corporatism.
Oh yeah,
that's all it is.
If you were to take the rural agriculture out of the economy, and you were to take bars, barbers, beauticians out of the economy, what percentage left is anywhere near competition?
Yeah,
I mean, I'd say food stores probably still are.
Yeah. That's maybe a research I'm going to have to do in the future.
I gotta start working with you on some of this research. Data. You need some of my input, or maybe you don't. Anyway, thanks, bud. Hey, do you want to opine at all on some of this veteran stuff as we move forward?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Being in this group on Friday is really eye-opening.
Well, let's talk about that next Tuesday, because we'll have like 4 segments by then, and then we'll get you involved as well.
Okay, sounds good.
Right, take care, bud. SP Futures now down 7. There's down 78. NASDAQ Futures still down 400. We haven't budged back at all here. We'll tell you how bad it is or how good we come back tomorrow morning.
That's all, folks.